Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of Vital Minds.
Vital Minds is a podcast series brought to you by the PA Foundation, the philanthropic arm of the American Academy of PAs. I'm James Millward, also a PA, and your host for this podcast. As a PA in cardiothoracic surgery, I am very excited about our guest today because we deal with a lot of patients who have long-standing diabetes. We have with us an expert in the field. This is Scott Urquhart. He's PAC and a distinguished fellow of the AAPA. Scott graduated from George Washington University's PA program and has been practicing in endocrinology since 1996 here with the Diabetes and Thyroid Associates in Fredericksburg, Virginia. He's also a founding member and past president of the American Society for Endocrine PAs, and is the founder and chair of the Metabolic and Endocrine Disease Summit that is held each year. Scott, it's great to have you with us today.
Thank you. Appreciate it, James.
First of all, let's just set the stage a little bit for our audience here. Can you tell us a little bit about the relationship that you have found and you see between especially type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease in your patients?
Yeah, great question. And you know, one of the things we deal with within diabetes is that you can't separate cardiovascular disease and diabetes. They're almost, you know, one in the same. The statistics that we look at, that there's a 1.5 to 2 times increased rate for stroke and heart attack in patients, you know, with diabetes. The United Kingdom Prospective Diabetes Study showed that for every 1% decrease in A1C, we actually saw benefits to decrease risk for heart failure, for stroke, and also for MI. So we know that the glucose is important. But as you know, in your field and in primary care and internal medicine, we see that the lipids are important, the hypertension is important, the obesity is important. Mm-hmm. I think one of the staggering things we look at is that adults with diabetes are 2 to 4 times more likely to die of cardiovascular disease, and that 2 out of 3 of our patients with type 2 diabetes will die of cardiovascular events. So it's really high. It's almost it's almost definable that will be the mean cause of death, you know, for them.
Very closely.
It's hard
related.
To separate them. Very difficult to separate them. Yeah.
So as providers, what are you seeing in the ways that we need to change the way we're addressing these patients to decrease this long-term risk of cardiovascular disease and death that comes as a complication of their diabetes?
Early modifiable risk factors is one. Obviously, we can't change genetics. We don't pick our parents, you know, and many of us would probably like to in these situations. But when we look at, like, the American Heart Association, you know, considers diabetes, you know, one of the 7 modifiable risk factors for heart disease. And for example, we can look at hypertension, dyslipidemia, obesity, habitual inactivity, you know, smoking, some of these modifiable risk factors. So it should really start early, even into the school age and teenagers, of how do we reconstruct the way in which children are moving forward and living and dietary and exercise, and it really comes from the parents. So I think those things are all important. But it's really going to be how soon do we, you know, intervene from at least a diabetes standpoint. We have prediabetes and then we have diabetes. But, you know, but prediabetes is a metabolic condition. Should we wait until they get diabetes or should we intervene sooner? Because we know that dysglycemia also increases the risk for macrovascular events the same way. So I guess the challenge we have, it's different, is that you're dealing with patients that already have established cardiovascular disease and need revascularization, for example. We're trying to prevent them from getting to that point by use of medications and, you know, therapeutic lifestyle and behavioral change. And that's really where the crux of it probably is getting patients to change their lifestyle and their behavior. And that's very difficult.
Mm-hmm. You know? Now, as far as the tools we have as clinicians, there's been a lot of changes to drugs and new information coming out as we understand more about diabetes and its link to cardiovascular disease. What tools are you finding that are effective in your practice that are new or coming out for type 2 diabetes?
Our newest tools, and I'll go back to when I started practicing, you know, endocrinology in 1996, and there was kind of a dry season, if you will, that occurred from 1996 to 2000, where we didn't have much more than sulfonylureas, and the brand was glucophage, which is now, you know, known as metformin.
Yeah.
But that's all we really had was sulfonylureas, insulin, and then metformin. And in 2000, we had kind of this explosion, and from like 2000 until now, we have 45 new medications, you know, either individually or in combination. So lots and lots of choices, which can actually make it more difficult to treat. What has really happened would basically how we used to look at clinical outcomes. You know, drugs were looking at the comparator to see if they were better than the comparator. you know, if you will. And then in 2008, the FDA gave guidelines to the pharmaceutical industry to say, hey, we're going to start looking at cardiovascular risk, and they're going to be compared to placebo, and they need to make sure that these medications don't have an unacceptable increase in cardiovascular events or cardiovascular risk, and therefore they would be non-inferior to placebo. That means we're safe.
Yeah.
But what was discovered recently in one of the trials first time was the EMPA-REG trial with empagliflozin, is they actually saw in that trial for non-inferiority that they were able to demonstrate superiority if non-inferiority was met. And as a result, we see a decreased risk in MACE endpoints, so non-fatal stroke, non-fatal MI, and CV death. So these drugs are now showing that they show a decreased risk in those MACE endpoints, but also decrease in heart failure, which was also demonstrated in the CANVAS trial. Mm-hmm. Now, that's within the newest class to come to market was the SGLT2 inhibitors. And just prior to that class was our GLP-1 receptor agonist. And the LEADER trial has come out in that particular trial using liraglutide, showing the same thing, decreasing these MACE endpoints. And these drugs are indicated to be used as prevention of cardiovascular events in patients with established cardiovascular disease. So not only diabetes drugs, we're seeing additional benefits in cardiovascular prevention, decreasing in cardiovascular events. So it is an exciting time right now, and there's many trials, you know, coming forth that we'll be looking at.
Now, in your management of the patients, when do you find it appropriate to begin adding those drugs in?
So we look at the American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists and the American Diabetes Association gives us, you know, a guideline or an algorithm, and it's just that it's a kind of a consensus algorithm. Where do we go with medications? Mm-hmm. And in metformin and lifestyle is really first mainstay therapy, and then there's additional add-on drugs that are based on, you know, reduction in A1C, so glycemic control, side effect profiles, tolerability, cardiovascular risk, weight gain, other factors that we look into place. And then you could also factor in, you know, cost, for example. But second to metformin, many of us probably would have chosen a DPP-4 inhibitor because it's an oral and patients have pushback because they don't want to inject. Mm-hmm. And then we have weight loss that can be associated with the SGLT2 inhibitors and with the GLP-1 receptor agonist, and one's an injectable, but if they're going to get some weight loss, they're willing to take that injection because there's a benefit and there's no associated weight gain with it. So those drugs that were going to come in later and are now moved up, and I think now with these cardiovascular outcome trials, I think they're going to come as a higher favored second in the algorithm. And then the patients, roughly 6% of patients, don't tolerate metformin or can't tolerate it at all, which now means first-line therapy isn't first line. So those drugs that were 2, 3, and 4 now fall into 1, 2, and 3 slots.
Yeah.
So definitely exciting. Lots of medications. Diabetes is fully manageable. Mm-hmm. Lots of agents available. So it is exciting to know that we can do more and get a bigger bang for the buck out of a drug than just glycemic control, since diabetes is not really just a glucose-centric disease.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, as we were talking about that, for the patient, what does this mean for them? Because this is obviously, like we said, management of it. For us, it's a complex disease, and this can be a very overwhelming diagnosis for a patient. So what do you find is kind of the most effective way to handle your patient's concerns when it comes to taking all these new drugs and insurance aspects of this, too? How are they paying for this? How do you find you guys managing that successfully here?
Does science and success always equate to the payer thinking we should pay for the medication? And I think the answer is probably no.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, obviously, there are companies, they're, you know, they got shareholders, they're making money, et cetera. Whatever the reasoning is behind it, we look at things differently from a scientific standpoint. Many companies do have good coverage. So when we're looking at adding on medications, you know, how do we navigate? The best way to navigate that is really the art of listening to the patient. You know, what do they want? What are they concerned about? What can they pay for? Do you have good insurance? It doesn't do us any good to say you need drug B after A because it's the right drug and they're uninsured, underinsured, or have, you know, a $7,000 or $8,000 copay. They can't take what they cannot afford, or they can't do it for very long. So somehow between the minds of medicine and the payers that pay for the medication, can there come this road in between where we can all meet together and understand that there are a handful of drugs that do have additional benefits that do warrant decrease in morbidity, in mortality, cardiovascular risk, et cetera.
Yeah.
So hopefully that will mean something with the new studies coming out. These are just the past couple of years. So hopefully that will mean something to payers where they have a true heart for understanding what patients go through.
Yeah.
But really listening to the patient, understanding their fears, their concerns. Mm-hmm. It's very important because it's really about that relationship building that helps you get them to move into the proper agents and why we're choosing certain medications.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Now, kind of continuing along that, in every episode, we like to give our viewers some advice. What advice would you have for our listeners as far as to the PAs, the new students coming out in relation to type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and managing that for your patients?
We both have said the same thing. We have such an armamentarium of individual drugs and combination medications that are safe and extremely effective. How do you come in and just gather and get all this together? When I looked back at what was needed in 2010, it's really about understanding the science of what's available, when do we add it in. But it's the art, right? It's the art of medicine. It's the listening, which is a skill within itself, when a patient wants to communicate. And I think one of the most important things is making sure that we understand the science, we know how to communicate that with our patients. The more we know and become comfortable and confident, the better we can relay the information to our patients in such a fashion that they won't run to the internet doubting what we had to say or watching the commercial and doubting the value
and
effect
Google.
Of the medication. But getting plugged into good conferences, good summits, podcasts, webcasts, any of those where they can actually learn good, solid information about what's available. The biggest hang-up in most of this is going to be formulary coverage and cost for most of our patients. I sit on many ad boards, and they want to know how we can bring drugs to market. And you can say affordability, but coverage is very important. Healthcare costs are through the roof. Mm-hmm. Most people can't even get into the point of being able to just pay their premium, which is the same as their mortgage. Just taking an initiative to really understand the disease process and working with a team. Cardiology, primary care, endocrinology, diabetic educators, dietitians, mental health specialists, all those people come together, work together for the good of the patient.
Yeah, the whole spectrum.
Absolutely.
Very good. Well, and with that, we would like to end this episode of Vital Minds. We thank you very much for tuning in, and we thank you very much, Scott, for being with us and kind of helping us delve through the very complex issue of diabetes and cardiovascular health. We encourage you to swing by the PA Foundation's website at pa-foundation.org for additional information on diabetes and cardiovascular disease. As well, you can find all of our episodes on Vital Minds on the website there.
Support for this episode of Vital Minds is from Novo Nordisk, a global healthcare company with more than 90 years of innovation and leadership in diabetes care and experience that enables them to help people defeat other serious chronic conditions, including rare bleeding disorders, growth hormone-related disorders, and obesity.
Until next time, everybody, I'm James Millward, and this has been Vital Minds. Thank you.